Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Primary day in Philadelphia is 3 weeks away on May 21st. And so today we begin our series of interviews with the candidates for mayor. Former city controller Alan Butkovitz will join us shortly. The Democrat is challenging Mayor Kenney on some significant issues, including the soda tax and stop and frisk. We'll also have a look at a relatively new program which is encouraging Philly residents to go solar with discounts for installation. But to begin the show today, we catch up to the Sixers. Five often wretched years after the process to rebuild began, they find themselves up against the Raptors in the Eastern Conference semifinals. Game one on Saturday was tough to watch at times. The outcome perhaps not unexpected. Raptors 108, Sixers 95. The Sixers are a different and better team this year, but the Raptors have proven themselves a thorn in the side of Philadelphia for a long time. Mike Sielski is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, and he's here now with his take. Hi, Mike. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mary. Always a pleasure.
So a bucket of cold water doused the excitement of Sixers fans Saturday night, and his name is Kawhi Leonard. He has been compared to some of basketball's all-time greats, Michael Jordan, and Saturday night, we saw why. 45 points?
Yeah, he's pretty darn good. Not only is he a terrific scorer, but he is one of the probably one or two best defensive players in the entire NBA. Anybody who he covers is pretty much going to be shut down. And the Sixers, on the flip side, couldn't do anything with him, you know, when he had the ball on offense. And this is a primary problem that the Sixers knew they were going to face coming into this series against Toronto, that Leonard is just that good, and he's not the only weapon that the Raptors have.
Yeah, third-year player Pascal Siakam as well. Ironically, he and Joel Embiid know each other. They're both from Cameroon, and they have a friendly correspondence. But, yeah, he's another roadblock for the Sixers. Possibly. It was just one game.
Yeah, but, you know, I think anyone who was kind of looking at this series fairly coming into it understood that the Sixers had a fairly uphill climb to try to win this thing. It's still possible they will. It's certainly possible that they can recover. But they're a bit of a bad matchup with the Raptors. The Raptors are deeper. They can match them talent-wise. They also acquired a center named Mark Gasol just before the trade deadline this season from the Memphis Grizzlies. And Gasol is a two-time league defensive player of the year. He gives Embiid absolute fits. He's big enough and smart enough to be able to kind of neutralize Embiid on the inside. So the Sixers have their work cut out for them in this series.
All right, so let's talk about Coach Brett Brown. He has said this is the third Sixers team of the season. There have been some big acquisitions on the Sixers side. Let's talk about them.
Well, yeah, I don't think Brett is wrong to say what he said about, you know, coaching different iterations of this team. They started out this year with kind of bringing back a team very similar to the one they had last year that advanced the second round of the playoffs before losing to the Boston Celtics. And then some early season struggles kind of convinced them, general manager Elton Brand in particular, that they needed to make some changes to really try to make a deep playoff run. So they go out and make a big trade to acquire Jimmy Butler. And then later on, they make another big trade to acquire Tobias Harris. So at this point, the Sixers starting five of Harris, Butler, Embiid, Ben Simmons, and J.J. Redick are about as talented as you can find in the NBA, short of the Golden State Warriors, who have won three of the last four championships. The problem is the Sixers don't have a lot of depth, and they don't have a lot of cohesion. You know, you see teams that have been successful in the NBA over time, they generally keep the same group together over several years. The Sixers have not done that, and they're kind of learning each other on the fly as they try to get to the Eastern Conference Finals and even the NBA Finals.
Yeah. Joel Embiid was questionable throughout the series with the Nets because of soreness in his left knee. How's he look?
Well, he didn't look great in game one. He had looked terrific coming back after sitting out game three against the Nets. He played very, very well in games four and five, but he did not look good in game one against the Raptors. Now, part of that is because, as I said, Marc Gasol is a terrific defensive player and plays Embiid very well. But the Sixers need Embiid to be great. He is their absolute centerpiece. He is the guy. As he goes, they go. They are not going to be able to beat the Raptors. They're going to struggle to beat any playoff team if Joel Embiid is not playing at his best, and he was far from it in game one.
The Sixers are also up against Toronto's home field advantage or home court advantage. And the fact that I think, Mike, they've lost 13, maybe 14 straight games there since 2012. What is it about an arena or a crowd that can turn into a thing for players of the opposing team?
Well, let's take the Sixers versus the Raptors in and of itself first. The Sixers have had so many different versions of themselves over the last 6 years that most, if not all, of those losses, with the exception of game one, came with different teams from the one that is playing against the Raptors now. Now, having said that, you're exactly right that home teams have an advantage in the NBA, and there have been studies about this showing that referees are kind of unconsciously biased toward a home team, that plays a role. Obviously, the noise and the atmosphere within a home arena can favor the home team as opposed to the visiting team. You know, you see that a lot at the Wells Fargo Center. The Sixers are a much, much better team at home than they are on the road. And, you know, that's kind of a general rule throughout professional sports. But it certainly seems to be particularly exacerbated when the Raptors play the Sixers. And again, part of that is just because the Raptors have been a very, very good team for several years, whereas the Sixers, after, as you mentioned, those hard years of the process when they were rebuilding, had been really bad for 4 or 5 years and only been really good in these last two.
Yeah. Well, when the process began, you know, what, about 5 years ago, there was a lot of pushback. There were observations that this is a bad business model. I mean, the Sixers are a good team. Looking at where they are today, maybe it wasn't such a bad model.
No, I thought it was a very good model. It was a very difficult model. And I think the two concepts get confused sometimes. The fact is that the NBA, because of the nature of basketball and because the league has a salary cap, is a very top-heavy league. If you have, you know, star players, if you're the Cleveland Cavaliers and you have LeBron James, if you're the Golden State Warriors and you have Steph Curry and Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson, you're going to have a much, much better chance of winning a championship, and that plays out and is shown to be true over time. It's something like, I think, 10 or 11 teams – franchises have been responsible for winning the last 30 or 32 NBA championships. There's not a lot of parity in the league. So what the Sixers did was they said to themselves, look, the way we're going to get great players is not by signing for them or trading for them. You have to draft them. You have to get them here out of college. So they were willing to be bad for several years in the name of trying to get great later. And it allowed them to get Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, and it helped them accumulate enough assets to make trades to get players like Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris. They're better than they were, but there was never a guarantee that it was going to turn them into a championship-caliber team. They're a lot closer than they used to be, but they're not quite there yet.
They need more playing time together?
I think that's part of it. I think they've got to hope that some of their younger players, for instance, Jair Smith, who they drafted or they traded for in the first round this past year, missed most of the season because of various injuries and actually allergies. They have to hope that guys like that are able to develop and grow into contributing players. They really turned themselves into kind of a top-heavy team this season. And it's going to be interesting to see how they're able, if at all, to kind of reshape the roster to get more talent up and down their lineup.
So, again, game two happens tonight in Toronto. What has to happen for the Sixers to win?
They've got to get a better game out of Joel Embiid. They've got to get a better game out of Jimmy Butler. And they're going to have to find a way, I think, and this sounds crazy, to make Kyle Lowry, one of the Raptors' best players and actually a Philadelphia native, beat them. You know,
wait, that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, but the Raptors are much deeper than the Sixers are, and they've got different options available to them to try to beat any opponent that they play. And the Sixers aren't going to win if they allow Kawhi Leonard to play the way that he did in game one. So it's not just a matter of kind of shutting Leonard down. They've got to kind of dare Kyle Lowry, who has not been a great playoff performer over time, to beat them. Now, that may very well happen. He may play great, and the Sixers may end up down 2-0 in this series, but I think that's the Sixers' best bet to come back to Philadelphia later this week with the series tied at 1.
Okay. At the end of the day, the team to beat is Golden State?
Absolutely still Golden State. You know, I think one of the interesting parts of the NBA, factors in the NBA over the last few years, is in some ways how irrelevant the regular season has become. You know, you saw that a bit from the Warriors this season. As I said, they've won three of the last four championships. They kind of cruise through the regular season at times, and we in the sports media end up having these discussions and speculations about, oh, is this the end of the dynasty? You know, they're not playing well now. It's December, it's January. Here we are. It's, you know, the end of April. We're about to begin May, and the Warriors look just fine. They're winning their series against the Rockets. I would be very surprised if they weren't in the finals again and if they didn't win the championship again. I would say Golden State is the team to beat.
Okay, so back to the Sixers for just a second. Again, game two tonight in Toronto, and then they're back in Philly, I think, on Thursday, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, let's turn to football for just a sec. Quick check-in with the NFL draft. Question of the backup quarterback, you know, Nick Foles, obviously no longer with the team. The Eagles have drafted Northwestern quarterback Clayton Thorson. Who is he, and where does Nate Sudfeld, the other backup, fit into the picture?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, the Eagles generally, as a rule, like to draft quarterbacks, maybe one every other year, because quarterbacks are so valuable as commodities within the NFL. And if you can develop them, you might stumble upon one who turns out to be a terrific player who you might either keep or you might trade for draft picks or players down the road. The Eagles don't have any – they're not looking to supplant Carson Wentz in any regard. If anything, they're looking to sign him to a long-term contract. And they like Nate Sudfeld as his backup. Sudfeld has been with the team for a couple of years now. They think he has a lot of talent. You know, picking a quarterback in this draft is simply about, let's get someone in here who we think is talented, who has a good head on his shoulders, and we can develop him. And maybe he's our number three guy. Maybe he becomes something more than that down the road. But the idea of keeping a stable of quarterbacks is part of it's been part of the Eagles' philosophy for years. It was under Andy Reid. It's continued under Howie Roseman, and it's not going to change anytime soon.
And especially since as good as Wentz is, he does tend to get injured.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you have Nate Sudfeld there, and I think the Eagles feel confident that if Wentz were to get hurt again, that Sudfeld could step in and perform similarly to the way Nick Foles did. Now, I don't think anybody would expect Nate Sudfeld to lead the Eagles to a Super Bowl, but, you know, sacrifices have to be made, and Nick Foles wanted to be a starter somewhere else as much as he loved Philadelphia and as much as Philadelphia loved him. So the idea that you were going to pay him $20, $25 million a year to back up Wentz again just didn't make sense financially. It didn't make sense for Foles. And so Sudfeld is the man in waiting if Carson Wentz gets hurt again.
All right. And one quick note, in about 10 seconds, Philly's hanging on to first in the the National League East. Yes, that's right. So, and yeah. Zach Eflin with his first complete game.
It would be to the Phillies' huge benefit if Zach Eflin were to become a solid number three starter behind Aaron Nola and Jake Arrieta. That was what happened yesterday. Was an excellent development for the Phillies.
All right, Mike Sealski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Mary. Thanks.
All right. Up next, former Philadelphia City Controller Alan Butkovitz. He's running for mayor of Philadelphia. If you'd like to call us, 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay tuned. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia's primary election day is coming up fast, May 21st. And today we begin a series of interviews with those who are running for mayor. Former city controller Alan Butkovitz is a Democrat who is challenging incumbent Mayor Jim Kenney. And he joins us now in studio. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Alan Butkovitz, why run for mayor?
Because the city's got very serious crises right now. There's a homicide and crime crisis. There's a poverty crisis, which is really the shame of Philadelphia. And Mayor Kenney is really not managing the city. He's not managing the crime problem. We have a perpetual annual tax increase machine, which was never true in Philadelphia. The schools aren't getting any better. And I've had a strong record, both in the legislature and as controller, at getting things done, solving problems, bringing people together, being cutting edge in innovation. When I was the city controller, we won national awards every year of my 12 years for being cutting edge. And I think that we have to do something about getting high-paying jobs for people who have missed their chance at high school. I think that means a major expansion of port operations. there's now a five-day delay in New York getting a ship unloaded. And aside from the fact that Philadelphia is a natural port, one of the great things about that kind of economic strategy is that you don't need a high school diploma to be a longshoreman, and yet you can make $100,000.
There was a poll in the Philadelphia Inquirer today, a new poll. You referenced the homicide rate. City voters say the top issues for them are crime, poverty, and education. Let's talk about the homicide rate for a moment. It's an issue which has stumped elected officials for as long as many of us can remember. Last year, the city did see an increase in homicides to 351, although crime overall was down. Where would you begin, Alan Butkovitz, as mayor, in an effort to lower the number from 351?
First of all, Philadelphia has been a pioneer at dealing with generations of this kind of problem. Back in the late 60s, Benny Swans and the Crisis Intervention Network were pioneers at putting together a peace treaty among gangs in the city schools. In the 2000s, both Lynn Abraham as the DA and the 24th Police District achieved very strong results on a program called Focus Deterrence, where they were able to tell because of juvenile contacts, truancy and other such indicators who likely murderers or murder victims were and do early intervention. We just haven't funded and continued those programs. We ought to do that. But secondly, guns are a big part of the problem. Drugs and guns are big parts of the problem. So first of all, I mean, the police department ought to be a priority of the police department to gather the intelligence and to move in on the gun houses. I hear there are houses in Philadelphia where you can rent a gun for an hour. The police either know about it or they should know about it. And it ought to be a priority to get that under control and to make it clear that Philadelphia is not a free fire zone. When Mayor Street was in, he did Operation Sunrise. He paid a lot of overtime, but he moved drug dealers off of the corners and created a safe corridor for grandmothers and people to get to and from the grocery store without getting shot at. Mayor Kenney's initiative on so-called safe injection sites actually takes us in the opposite direction. It is an open invitation to the merchants of death who come in here trying to sell their fatal product, which is contaminated with fentanyl, and will inevitably produce shootouts for those valuable drug corners closest to where the injection sites are. I think Kenney has basically been in denial. He's done things like talk about statistics and other areas of crime. Look, we've had some very prominent sexual assaults in Center City, 10:30 at night on a Saturday, hours that people – I remember the beginning of the Come to Center City program. People had to be secure walking around Center City.
So
you know, it's going the opposite way.
Is Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross not doing the job? Would you keep him on were you to be elected mayor?
I really preferred the approach that Commissioner Charles Ramsey took. I thought Ramsey had stature. I thought he had knowledge, and I thought he fought for his department. If he thought the budget – or the restrictions in the police department was going to make it impossible for them to function effectively, he always had his resignation ready to go, and Mayor Nutter would never challenge him on that. On the same time, Ramsey was very aggressive about taking bad officers off of duty and trying to assert the full power of the commissioner. I don't know that it's Ross. I think Mayor Kenney is intervening in the functioning of the police department. For example, one of the problems that the media has noted is that police officers who've been found to have falsified evidence or planted evidence continue to work because that all gets decided by labor arbitrator rather than the police commissioner. There was a generous police contract. Police were allowed to move out of the city, and yet the mayor didn't take any action to get control of the police department back in the hands of the commissioner.
Let's get back to safe injection sites for just a moment. This is where drug users are supervised while injecting heroin. You referenced this a little bit ago. But this is to help prevent fatal overdoses because, as you well know, there is an excruciating opioid crisis, not just throughout the country, but focused in Philadelphia, in particular in Kensington. Users would also be steered toward treatment. So you are not in favor of safe injection sites. Where would you begin as mayor to begin to address the crisis of opioid abuse and homelessness in the city of Philadelphia?
Well, people who are in addiction don't know that they have a problem. I mean, they do need help being pulled out of it, just like people in mental illness or with alcoholism. So I appreciate that, and we need more dollars and more beds on that. And the other issue. I don't have experience with this in the opioid area, but I have been a caregiver in the family, and I know that what happens in this system is that as soon as somebody in the family raises their hand and say, I help out, the system backs off and dumps the problem on you. So I think part of that is that family members ought to be assisted in the way Al-Anon does for families of alcoholics, so that they get the skills and they get the support that they need to help. I think the injection, I think the word safe injection site is a is an oxymoron, that there is no safe way to kill yourself, that in injecting heroin, you have to do higher and higher doses to get any high out of it, that it's almost all contaminated by fentanyl, and that it is kind of a digression to say that nobody died inside a injection site, because if they step onto the sidewalk or they go home and crawl into the bathtub, as my secretary's brother did, and die there, that counts too.
But the point of the safe injection site is to not have them go into the sidewalk. It's to revive them in case there is an overdose and hopefully steer users toward treatment and eventual rehabilitation, which has been one of the more the tougher aspects of this crisis, getting people into treatment and getting them to stick with it.
Well, of course, the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous is that to enable people is to make it harder and harder to cure the problem, that in fact, people have to come to a recognition that they're up against the wall, that things are getting really bad. I heard testimony by a woman lawyer 2 years ago who said that she was on increasing dosages of opioids and she was forging prescriptions. And she thanks God that she was arrested in Montgomery County and served 11 and a half months in prison, because she said otherwise she would be dead. It's a hard, intractable problem. People who have loved ones in addiction are frustrated and looking, we got to do something. But the encouragement to people, the imprimatur that it's okay, that there is such a thing as a safe injection of heroin, first of all, hurts. You can't count how many people that hurts. And secondly, I've been reading articles about three-year-olds who were shot and killed sitting on the sofa in their home because drug dealers were out in the street shooting up their neighborhoods.
So again, a first step for a Butkovitz administration would be what?
Would be expanding the resources necessary to treat people in addiction and to bring their families and their loved ones and their contacts into a support network.
Let's talk about the Philadelphia soda tax. In effect, 2 years now, it's raised millions for expanded pre-K and construction projects, which include rebuilding parks and libraries. Health advocates say fewer sweetened beverages help to fight obesity, which can disproportionately affect the poor. You are against the tax. Why?
Because the city doesn't seem to have much of a memory. 10 years ago, we had a major crisis in the city in that there were no supermarkets. Merchants like Jeff Brown put their financial security on the line and built some great ShopRites and other supermarkets, which pay union wages, which hired about 600 people returning from prison, gave them a career path. And the facts of life for him in maintaining business is that soda provides a pyramid that brings customers into the store. He's only operating on a 1.5% profit margin, and the city now slaps him in the face. Mayor Kenney calls him a bad businessman. He had to close a store, and who knows what's going to happen to his family's financial future. When the city of Philadelphia shakes hands and makes a deal, businesses have to know that that's the city of Philadelphia. It's not just the mayor at the time the deal was made. Now we've gone blind in all that. We lost the ShopRite at 67th and Haverford. I understand we're about to lose another supermarket of another brand. And to me, life is a compromise. And you have to do what you have to do. And now we are bringing into the inner city fresh vegetables, fresh food, access to people didn't think you could make a profit there. We are. As a diabetic, I would say the prevailing theory among nutritionists now is not the nanny state, not to tell people, you know, you shouldn't eat a cupcake. They tell you this is the number of carbs you can mix into your diet. This is the amount of insulin. Because similar to what we were talking about a moment ago about opioid addicts, people need to feel that they have power over their nutritional choices.
Alan Butkovitz, most voters would agree with you. They, according to this Inquirer poll, they say the soda tax is a failure, 62%. 55% say it should be repealed. But they also say they like the pre-K programs, the soda tax funds, by a 3-to-1 margin. So that's overwhelming. How do you provide funding for pre-K? in Philadelphia for an expansion of pre-K without further stressing the pocketbooks of Philadelphians.
I was the first person, a city controller, to say that the soda tax was not connected to the programs it was allegedly going to support. Remember, half of the money raised by the soda tax goes to general city expenses, and more money is devoted to the so-called rebuild playground reconstruction project than to – it's only $20 million going to pre-kindergarten. Governor Wolf offered to substitute to pay that money from the state last year. We had a chance to increase the city sales tax by 0.5%. Rebuild isn't even happening. It's a fiction. The reason it's not happening is because council members – will not approve a $500 million public works project that does not provide a wedge, an opening for minorities, for black people to get jobs in the construction industry.
But is that the fault of the soda tax?
That's the fault of the Kenney administration. He lied about what he's using the soda tax for in that he said he's going to fix these playgrounds. What playgrounds? I saw that they had two ribbon cuttings this year, and both of them involved raking the ground and marking up tennis courts, not construction. So he's got money, he's got it in the general fund. It's been 3 years. It has been 3 years since they enacted the soda tax. Nothing's happening on rebuild.
So how would you, as mayor, fund the rebuilding of public parks and libraries, which are crumbling, and also an expansion of pre-K, which we've done numerous shows on education on Radio Times. The experts all say it's good for children, especially those who are disadvantaged, in order to level the academic playing field in education.
Look, I supported pre-kindergarten before Jim Kenney did. I've been voting for tax increases and for the Governor Ed Rendell tax increase that was specifically for pre-kindergarten. That's why it's an oxymoron. Kenney passed the soda tax because John Dougherty told him to because he was mad at the Teamsters. He's got a $400 million surplus right now.
Where would the money come from in a buck of its administration, though? Where would you start to fund
where it's coming from in the Kenney administration? It came from massive real estate tax assessment increases. So Kenney's got pots of money all over the place. He's lost all credibility on financial matters. He says he's broke. He said he was going to get a 5% increase in real estate taxes. He tried to get 15. He's got 10. And within 1 year, he went from we're broke to we're swimming in $400 million. That means he doesn't know what he's doing. And then he actually tries to sell the story that we need this tax when it's obvious in front of everybody's face that his massive real estate tax assessment increases have created a very big surplus. All the while, he's increased overall spending by 20% in 3 years.
You say the assessments, the property value reassessments, are an attempt to squeeze more money out of taxpayers and that the city should be tax neutral. How would this benefit homeowners who say they're being taxed out of the city?
Because they would be treated just like taxpayers in Montgomery County and the suburbs and every single one of Pennsylvania's other 66 counties. Remember, AVI was sold to us on the basis it was going to have accurate values, not that it was going to produce money. The rule in every other Pennsylvania county is if the assessment value goes up, the rate has to go down so that the city doesn't make a profit on it. Philadelphia has now built a system that we never had before. We have guaranteed tax increases every year. 40% of the people in Philadelphia who are homeowners are in poverty. And the idea that they're going to squeeze backdoor tax increases out of everybody and make people think that this is necessary is just not true.
A spokesman for the Kenney administration, in response to your comments, told WHYY that if you're proposing revenue neutral reassessments, you need to cut city services. Do you agree?
It's preposterous. Kenney just increased spending by 20%. They say whatever they want to say. He's over a $5 billion budget now. He's trying to find ways to spend money. So he couldn't find $33 million in the city payroll accounts for an entire year. They don't know what they're doing on money. Kenney and Mike Dunn's comments on the financial condition of the city are just all wet. I had national awards every year as the city controller. I think I'm more of an authority of what the income and the outgo is in the city treasury than these people are, who don't seem to know what the impact of any of their financial decisions are.
All right. The new Inquirer poll shows that Jim Kenney at this point has a 48% approval rating by city voters. Since voters approved the city charter nearly 70 years ago, no incumbent mayor who's run for re-election has lost. Alan Bukovits, what makes you think you can rewrite the story and capture as much, you know, perhaps as much of the other 52% as you possibly can?
First of all, Bill Green didn't run because he knew he was going to lose, so that counts as a loss. Number two, 48% for an incumbent is a losing number. The cliche is if you're below 50, you're losing.
He's got the building trades behind him. So do you?
Well,
do you,
but what the question is, he's only got 48% of the voters. Number three, Michael Nutter on May 1st of 2007 was at 18%. 2 weeks later, he went up 20%. The same with Larry Krasner. Voters in Philadelphia don't really focus until the last 2 weeks. If Kenny, who has been exclusively on TV without being hit, is already below 50%, the next 3 weeks is going to be when the majority of Philadelphians really make up their mind. He is extraordinarily vulnerable in the African-American community because of the understanding that he did not provide African-Americans with jobs in the rebuild program, that he doesn't have any diversity in his administration, and that he broke his promise that he was going to run a coalition government. He is not even attending meetings in those communities. Given the demographic breakdown of the city, Kenny's popularity centers in Center City. That's not a majority of the city. He's got a problem in all of the neighborhoods of Philadelphia.
Alan Bukovits, to wrap up in a few words, what does Philadelphia mean to you personally?
Philadelphia is a livable, scalable city. It's got the best aspects of New York, but you can still start a business here. You can still be somebody in Philadelphia. In New York, you're swallowed up by the big machine. I think that Philadelphia is experiencing a rebirth, and we need to make sure that all people who are Philadelphians have a chance to participate in that and don't get run out of town because we're a newly discovered sixth borough of New York.
Former Philadelphia City Controller and Democratic candidate for mayor of Philadelphia, Alan Bukovits, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times. Up next, Emily Shapira is executive director of the Philadelphia Energy Authority. We're going to talk about a program in which Philly is pushing solar energy to residents with some new discounts. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As you might guess by the name, the goal of Solarize Philly is to encourage Philadelphians to go solar. The program promotes solar panel installation at homes throughout the city and was launched by City Council 2 years ago. Officials recently announced that enrollment this year would include an upgrade to make it easier for low-income residents to come on board. So, how is the program doing? Emily Shapira is executive director of Philadelphia's Energy Authority, and she's with us now in studio. So nice to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me.
When we think of solar opportunity, it's easy to envision, you know, farmland, maybe repurposed a whole rows of giant rectangular solar panels. But you say the solar potential for a city like Philadelphia is unbelievable. Tell us why.
Absolutely. So Philadelphia really had no solar market to speak of until a few years ago. There were a few early adopters that had gone ahead and put solar on their roofs or in their backyards. But people, just as you're saying, really didn't believe that Philly produces enough sun and that, you know, it would work here. But it turns out that it does. And in 2017, we launched Solarize Philly to really demonstrate that and help build a solar market here.
And you're talking about solar installation on homes across the city and across neighborhoods. So paint the picture for us a little bit. Row homes, say, we'll start there.
Yeah.
Where would solar panels go? How does that work with that particular structure?
So most of our customers over the last 2 years have been a regular classic Philly row house with a flat roof, these little, you know, 4 and 5 kW solar systems just put right on top of your roof. It's easy. It works. Despite what you may have heard in the past, solar technology has changed so quickly. So it's a great opportunity. And actually, on an average size Philly row house, you can put enough solar up there to cover 100% of the average household's electricity use.
Really?
Yeah.
So what sort of interest have you had?
So we're actually the largest solarized program in the country. In 2017, Philly was the fourth fastest growing solar market in the country as well. So we're seeing a huge uptake. We have had over 4,200 households express interest. We had 363 households go forward in the first two rounds and actually put that solar up on their roof. And we've seen really huge growth each year over year in Philadelphia and solar. So we're really hoping that this year people will see 2019 is the year to go solar on their homes in Philly. There's a federal tax credit that starts to step down after 2019. It's 30% of the value. So it's a huge incentive to do it now.
So let's start at step one. As a homeowner, you're interested. There's this 30% tax credit that ends at the end of this year, and I think it phases out over the next few years entirely. You want to get in on it. How do you know your home is right for solar? Because not every home is right for solar, correct?
Absolutely. So the easiest thing to do is just to sign up online, solarizephilly.org. It doesn't commit you to anything. It lets you get a free assessment from one of our installers, and they'll tell you if it works for your home or not. They'll do a complete sun assessment, figure out how many sun hours you get or don't get. And if it works...
What does that mean? So tell us about sun hours.
It's just the amount of time that the sun shines on your roof. That's all.
What do you need to make it worth it? 4 hours, 10 hours?
Well, I think there it can vary. It depends how much electricity you use. But if you get a ton of shade, it's probably not a good fit. We've had people sort of evaluate, you know, I've got an older dead tree that I might need to take down anyway, so maybe I'll still do it. But that first step is to just sign up, and then they'll tell you. They'll do satellite imaging and let you know right away whether it's a good fit for your home.
And the installers work with the Energy Authority?
Yep, exactly. So what the Energy Authority has really done here with Solarize Philly is we ran a public procurement, and we selected and vetted installers. So each year we've done that same thing. We had 3 installers in the last 2 rounds. This year we have 4. And we've set up a set of consumer protections with those installers. We've negotiated great discounts for Solarize Philly customers. And we vetted the equipment as well as the financing options. So everything you'll get under Solarize Philly has been sort of reviewed and approved and sort of, you know, done a bit better than you might see on the open market.
So what is the average cost for installation of a typical Philadelphia home? And if you don't feel you have the means, but you want to get in on the program, what are the options?
Great question. So again, it really varies depending on your roof, depending on your utility consumption, all of those things. But I would say the average to sort of keep in the back of your mind is somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 as an upfront investment. You sort of think about it as you would any other big piece of equipment in your house. And really, we think about it as, you know, would you rather pay PICO or would you rather pay yourself, make an investment in yourself? The average payback is about 10 years in Philly. And we're finding that it's about at cost parity with what you would pay to PICO. So, you know, the loan that you would take on to pay for your solar would equal about the same as you would be paying in your PICO bill. So we're seeing people sort of net out to zero in that first year, which has been great. And we've offered a low and moderate income special financing pilot as well this year.
So what does that involve, especially for people who are on the lower end of the income scale?
Yeah. So and really, we found it's at the lower end of the income scale, but also folks with, you know, credit challenges or, you know, debt to income ratio challenges or anything like that. We set up a program to really provide a low cost lease product that would be a 15 or 20 year lease. So a third party owns the panels that are on your roof and you're buying the power from it, essentially.
So, and at the end of the day, you might save on your electricity bill. So it would be a wash, or you might even come out ahead?
In that program, we actually are targeting a 20% electricity savings from day one. So that's the math we've done there, and we're able to subsidize that program a bit through previous rounds of Solarize Philly from funds raised there.
Emily Shapiro, tell us about the concept of net metering and whether this applies to Philadelphians.
Yes, it of course applies to Philadelphians for sure. So when you have solar on your roof, you consume what you produce first, and then the rest goes back into the grid. And PICO buys it back from you at the same price you would have paid PICO for that power.
So you see that taken off your bill?
Exactly right. So in some months, in, you know, very sunny months in the summertime, you'll have no PICO bill probably. You'll in fact have a credit that sits on your account. And on May 31st of every year, it sort of gets trued up. And PICO will either write you a check or roll it over to future years. But typically, we're working to size those systems so that you are as close to 100% as possible. So your production offsets your consumption.
So you said about 4,200 property owners have signed up since the launch. About 360 contracts have been signed. Did I get that number right?
You did.
What are the roadblocks? Because there's a big gap there.
Totally. Well, you can imagine it's a big investment, so it's not sort of a easy thing to say yes to. One of the things that we saw last year was that a lot of folks paid cash for the project. So we know that we're not reaching sort of all income levels yet, which is why we created this pilot program. So we have 30 households going through that this year. We're hoping that'll sort of be the model going forward. And then, you know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there about solar. So we've been really working to do that consumer education.
Such as what?
Well, I think people aren't sure whether it will protect your roof or harm your roof. And in fact, solar actually protects your roof. It sort of provides some cover, helps your roof last longer. I think people are, you know, just sort of afraid of new equipment. One thing that's really helped is having solar on the Eagles Stadium. I think folks see that and sort of get a comfort level with it that has been really helpful. You know, I think net metering is kind of a confusing concept. So, you know, it's a complicated project, but I think bottom line, you really take it from, you know, just paying PICO for something that you never get to keep and, you know, instead really focusing on making an investment in your home to an asset that you'll have for 25, 30 years that will result in essentially no utility bill.
Emily, we have an email from Richard who asks, are there any installation complications that might affect the integrity of the structure?
Like the integrity of the roof, I would imagine. So
So going in, you need to make sure your roof is in decent shape.
That's right. And everything gets a permit from L&I. Anything with truss roofs also has to have a building permit, not just an electrical permit. We do engineering studies and roof certifications for every property. So, you know, we're very confident that the equipment that we're using is good equipment and it's appropriate for the roofs we're putting it on.
And while you're looking at your roof, I've noticed this as I take the train from Philly to New Jersey, that many rooftops are coated in white as opposed to the black. And that can also be an energy saver.
Absolutely. And actually, we really encourage folks that go solar to do a white coating on their roof. There's actually a new product out that's a silicone coating that's also white that lasts even longer. It comes with a 25-year warranty. So we encourage folks that are doing solar to look at that as well as an option.
Solarize Philly has received some grant money to train high schoolers for jobs in the industry. What sorts of jobs and what sort of response have you seen?
Yeah, so this is actually now our third year training high school students. We've had three semesters of students that are doing sort of a condensed 6-week or 8-week class. We've trained a little over 50 students now in just the basics of electricity and solar installation to really give them a sense of what this career could be. We've seen with a lot of solar installer companies that there are just not a lot of trained people in this industry. So often they're taking people who have a little construction experience maybe or just a comfort with power tools, and they're training them themselves. And so we know there are all kinds of really brilliant CTE students, their career and technical education students in Philadelphia public schools who are really excited for this kind of job. It's the perfect entry-level job. It pays a living wage, about $15 an hour to start. There's room for growth. There's room for career. So we're really excited about this. And we just won a federal grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. That's a $1.25 million award over 3 years. And it'll help us to create the nation's first 3-year program of study for vocational training for high school students in clean energy. So we're really excited about
that. If any high schoolers or their folks are listening to this, just go online to Solarize Philadelphia. And that's a way to kind of find out how you can get into the program?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have our first class, actually of 12th graders. It'll be a 1-year program starting in the fall. So we're starting recruitment soon.
Tweet from Sarah, who says, I went solar last year with Solar States, and I love it. Last three PICO bills, $8.34, $10, and $10. Well, that's a sales pitch right there.
Absolutely.
Philadelphia's homes aren't the only potential source of solar energy. Mayor Kenney signed a bill at the end of 2013, which allows the city to enter into an agreement with the Energy Authority to buy nearly a quarter of the city's electricity at a fixed price. And this will eventually come from a solar facility to be built outside the city. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. So I'll start by saying the city of Philadelphia procures energy in a really sophisticated way. They're doing an incredibly good job, and we pay an incredibly low rate for power. And so one of the ideas that that office had, it's the city's energy office, which is under the Office of Sustainability, was to look for a way to get utility scale, low cost, clean energy into our mix. So the mayor's made a commitment to be 100% renewable electricity by 2030. So this is a big part of that. So the project is a 70 megawatt solar system, which is big ground mounted system in fields out in Adams County. The idea there is that that power is produced there and then actually physically delivered to the city of Philadelphia. We're able to do that because of how we buy. And it'll account for 22% of the city's electricity consumption. So it's a huge deal. It's actually the largest solar array in Pennsylvania by a factor of 7. And we're one of the first cities to really take a leadership role there in the country and do that kind of thing.
What percentage, I don't know if you have this information at your fingertips, Emily, but what percentage reliance is there today in Philly on fossil fuel? And do you see that the goal of 100% renewable energy within, 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. is that really achievable?
Yeah, I think it is achievable fairly easily because there's a lot of renewable power available to the grid. There are a few policies in Harrisburg that will make that a lot easier. The mix right now for the electricity grid for Philadelphia is okay. There's a lot of nuclear in it. There's a lot of natural gas in it. So there's still plenty of dependence on fossil fuels. And in order to make that transition, you know, the city taking a leadership role here is really important. So we see more projects like the one we've done over the next few years. The beauty of this Adams County project is that, one, it's close enough that we can do workforce training there with our own students from Philadelphia, that Philadelphia companies will be able to participate. And I think even more, it costs the same as what we pay now. In fact, it'll produce a savings over the next 20 years. So it's a great deal, actually. So when people say, you know, can we get to 100%? Sure, there's nothing in our way to do that.
Call from Michael, who asks, what can people who live just outside the city do to get solar energy in their homes? Any ideas? I know you work with the city primarily.
Yes. So there's no Solarize the Suburbs yet. We cover the city of Philadelphia. But just because there isn't a Solarize program doesn't mean you can't go ahead and do it. There are tons of companies now that are looking at Pennsylvania as a place to do solar. I think, you know, because we didn't have very favorable state level policies, it wasn't a place that was very attractive. You know, there's a mechanism called renewable energy credits. And in Pennsylvania, those were valued at about $5, whereas in New Jersey, they were $250. Hmm. And that kind of provides a subsidy to your project.
Sure.
So Pennsylvania wasn't very attractive for a long time. But now that the price of solar has come down so much and the installation costs have come down, we're seeing a huge uptake. So if you're in the suburbs, I would say go to our website. It's philaenergy.org. And you can click on the Solarize information, and there's contact information for all of the installers that are selected to participate in our program. They serve the suburbs as well.
I was going to say, it's key to find a good company
yeah.
to work with. Just very quickly, on the state level, you'd referenced this before, some state lawmakers, I should say there's a rescue package, proposed rescue package for the nuclear industry worth about $500 million. Some state lawmakers, or more Democrats now in the legislature, are also pushing renewables, wind and solar, et cetera. They want this to be part of the deal. It's a Republican majority legislature. Do you see that this might actually work its way into the deal? What are the odds?
I think the odds are actually pretty good for the first time.
What's the bargaining power on the solar and the renewable side?
It's all job creation.
Okay.
So solar creates more jobs than any other type of energy project that you can invest in. It's about 15 jobs for every 100 households. I'm sorry, it's one job for every 15 projects that go through. So it's a really high percentage of job creation, and they're good jobs. And I think legislators across the state are really seeing that in their districts and are excited about it. So I think it has a good chance of getting in there.
All right, Emily Shapira, it was a pleasure. Thanks for filling us in.
Thanks, Mary.
Emily Shapira is Executive Director of Philadelphia's Energy Authority, and we've been talking about the program called Solarize Philly. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about Radio Times, catch up to us on social media, or listen to our podcasts, head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along. for Radio Times.